Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of future awaits us as Asia's economies and global influence continue to grow? As Western anxiety grows over the imminent loss of U.S. and European control over global trade and power, people in Asia and Africa are rejoicing over the economic gains that are expanding their middle classes at an unprecedented rate. So how will the West adjust to this new reality, and what kinds of proactive changes might ease the transition? Kishore Mahbubani is the former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations and current dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. His new book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel. Kishore, welcome to Think.
I'm happy to be here.
So, as you well know, many Americans are wary, if not downright depressed, about the idea that China's economy will soon match ours and then surpass ours. Mm. How will that growth change life in the West?
Well, I have good news for the West. And the important message that I try to convey is that the reason why the rest of the world is succeeding now is that essentially the rest of the world is trying to replicate Western middle-class societies. And they want all the same things that Western middle classes want. You know, a flush toilet at home, a television set, education for their children, good health, good job, and so on and so forth. So that's why, as you know, the world is getting to be a better and better place. Wars are disappearing. Poverty is disappearing. Global middle classes are exploding. And at a time when, in a sense, the American project is succeeding at the end of the day, it's puzzling that Americans are depressed when they see the success of the project all over the world.
Meanwhile, you talk about the astonishing growth of the middle class in many parts of the world. By 2020, the middle class in Asia will have more than tripled from where it is right now in 2013. That's 7 years, and there will be three times as many people in the middle class.
It's amazing, because right now the total size of the middle class in Asia is about 500 million people, which is a significant sum, mm-hmm. more than the population of America. But in 7 years' time, that number is going to explode from 500 million to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. And the world has seen nothing like this, by the way. But I want to emphasize that my book is not just about Asia, you know. I mean, most people think of Africa as a place of bad news only. But in many ways, Africa is also replicating the Asian growth story. And in the last 10 years, 6 of the 10 faster-growing economies have been in Africa. And the current issue, The Economist has got a brilliant article about African aspirations, pointing out how well Africa has been doing in the last 10 years and how well it will do in the next 10 years. This is good news that the world hasn't heard.
And Africa, of course, is a great example of the achievement of at least some of the Millennium Development Goals.
Well, yes, because one of the key Millennium Development Goals was the halving of global poverty by 2015. Now, most of the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs as they're called, will not be met. But guess what? The halving of global poverty will be met because of the success of China, India, and Africa, and other places.
So you have this wonderful metaphor about the way the world has worked until recently and the way the world is working today. And it used to be that each individual country was like a boat on the ocean. Can you talk about all that?
Yes. I use the boat metaphor to sort of try to explain simply how the world has changed fundamentally. In the past, when 7 billion people live in 193 separate countries, it was like they were living in 193 separate boats with captains and crews taking care of each boat and rules to make sure that the boats didn't collide. And that's what the 1945 rules-based order was all about. But today, the world has shrunk. We've become so small and interdependent that 7 billion people no longer live in 193 separate boats. They live in 193 separate cabins on the same boat. But the problem is that you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin and no captain or crew taking care of the boat as a whole. And that's the big global challenge that we face today. And this is why I wrote my book to say, hey, it's time to strengthen institutions of global governance. Not global government. Global government will never happen. But global governance, all the institutions that we have to manage the common boat that we have, this is something we can and should strengthen in the years to come.
And strengthening is especially hard now because there has been a limitation of the amount that large countries, including the United States, are willing to add to the budgets of the UN.
Yes, unfortunately, see, it may have been rational policy to weaken multilateral institutions when the West was overwhelmingly dominant and could remain dominant forever. But as you know, I begin the book with a quote from President Bill Clinton in a speech that he gave in Yale in 2003. And in that speech, President Bill Clinton said, listen, if we in America believe we're going to be number one forever, then okay, let us carry on doing whatever we are doing. But if we can conceive of the possibility of a world emerging when we may no longer be number one, surely it is in America's national interest to try and create a rules-based order, which he didn't say so, will implicitly constrain the next number one, which will be China. So I'm appealing not to Western altruism or American idealism to say that we should strengthen these multilateral institutions and processes. I'm actually appealing to Western national interests and American national interests, because at the end of the day, the West only represents 12% of the world's population. 88% lives outside. And surely you want the 88% to be law-abiding and to obey international rules. And the best way that the West can do that is to lead by example.
It's telling, Kishore, that President Clinton made those remarks when he was, in fact, former President Clinton, not while he was in the White House. Can you talk about the reluctance that you found on the part of many U.S., current U.S. leaders to even acknowledge that this thing is not only on the horizon, but absolutely guaranteed to happen?
Yes. In fact, as you know, I reveal in the book that when President Bill Clinton was in the White House, he actually, because, you know, he's brilliant, so he could see how the world is changing. And as president, he wanted to alert the American people that let's prepare for a world when America is number two. But as Strobe Talbott, his then Deputy Secretary of State, reveals in his book that, you know what? They told him, Mr. President, if you talk of America as number two, that would be political suicide. You can't talk about it. And I discovered it at first hand again when in January 2012, in Davos at the World Economic Forum meeting, I was asked to chair a forum on the future of American power. And I had two Republican senators, Corker and Chambliss, and New York Congresswoman Nita Alowi, and Michael Froman, the Deputy National Security Advisor, on the panel, a very high-powered panel. So the first question I asked was a simple question. What do you see as the future of American power? Well, they all said, we'll be number one, we'll be number one, we'll be number one, we'll be number one. Then I said, you know, I've seen some statistics, some IMF statistics. And incidentally, the IMF statistics say that America may be number two in PPP, purchasing power parity terms, by 2017. I didn't get the year. I said, it may happen soon. So I asked these four distinguished panelists, how will America react as number two? And I was absolutely shocked by their responses, because it became clear that no American figure, public figure, can have any words coming out of his or her mouth saying if America becomes number two or when America becomes number two. In fact, Senator Corker was the smartest. He said something like, Mr. Chairman, I can do the maths. I see where you're leading us, but I'm not going there. And so that's the best he could do to acknowledge that America might become number two.
And it's obviously, your sense is that it's to our detriment to not acknowledge this and begin to take steps to prepare for it.
Yes, because, you know, you cannot change the world. You have to deal with the world, the reality of the world, and not a world that you wish to have. And the larger historical point I make, by the way, is in my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere, that if you look at the past 200 years of Western domination, right, you have to remember that from the year 1 to the year 1820, the two largest economies of the world were consistently China and India. And it's only in the last 200 years that Europe took off and then subsequently America took off. But if you view the last 200 years against the past 2,000 years, the last 200 years have been a major historical aberration. And all historical aberrations come to a natural end. So it is in the interest of the West to prepare for a world where it is no longer dominant, but then it creates a law-abiding universe that then constrains the emerging powers.
The United States is not a very old country, especially when you talk in those terms. Do you find that the U.S. is particularly unable to sort of recognize a time before the Industrial Revolution when the West was dominant to a greater extent even than people in Europe?
Well, I think America is a very unusual country. For most of its history, it's been a very successful country. Decade after decade, century after century, it's become stronger and stronger and stronger, reaching the peak at the end of World War II when it had close to 50% of the world's GNP. Now we are moving into a world where the absolute size of America's GNP will remain the same, will remain strong, and America will remain strong and powerful. In fact, the world wants to see a strong and powerful America, not a weak America. But America's relative share of the global GNP, it will begin to decline, and it's already begun to decline. In 1980, in purchasing power parity terms, America's share of the global GDP was 25%, and China's was only 2.2%, less than 10% of America. But by 2017, which is 4 years from now, America's share is going to decline to 17.6%, and China's will rise to 18.2%. And this is inevitable because, when you have 1.3 billion Chinese, all they have to do is perform at 25% the level of an average American. And then they'll have a larger GNP. And the likelihood is that they can probably perform more than 25%. They can probably perform 50% the level of an average American. Then they'll have a GNP which is twice the size of America's. Now, that's a very different world from what America has experienced since 1820. So now is the time to prepare for that new world.
And what are some of the ways that we can decide now to share power, to limit power of those at the top of global governance structures so that when we don't possess that power, there are limitations placed on whoever's in charge?
Well, the good news, as I give in the book, is that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit out there that America and the West can pluck. And one of the easiest low-hanging fruit to pluck is to completely discard this policy that America and Europe have had over the past 30, 40 years of keeping multilateral institutions weak. Now, this is the dirty little secret that I reveal in the book, because very few Americans, very few people in the West are aware that the reason why the United Nations is weak, the reason why specialized agencies like the WHO and IAEA are weak, is not because of incompetence on their part, but because it has been American and Western policy to keep them weak. And this policy should be dropped right now.
My guest is Kishore Mahbubani. He's a writer, professor, and former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations. His new book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth at 6:30 tonight at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kishore Mahbubani. He is a writer, professor, and former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations. His new book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. One concern I know that you have with the UN currently is the way that permanent seats on the Security Council are divvied up. Talk about, first of all, how it works now.
Well, as you know, at the end of World War II, they decided that the victors of World War II, the five, should have the five permanent membership seats. It means America, Soviet Union, then Russia, China, UK, and France. And then they have 10 elected seats. And for 20 years, they have set up something called the Open-Ended Working Group on Security Council Reform that has actually achieved nothing. There's been no change. And the reason why there's been no change is that for every new country that wants to come in, there's a neighbor that says, why not me? So for every Brazil that wants to come in, Argentina says, why not me? For Japan that wants to come in, there's a South Korea that says, why not me? And then for every India that wants to come in, there's a Pakistan that says, why not me? But the most ingenious was the Italian ambassador to the UN when I was there. Because when they were pushing very hard for Germany and Japan to join the UN Security Council, he got very exasperated and the Italian ambassador said very loudly, why are you only pushing for Germany and Japan? We in Italy, we lost World War II also. So but that's a powerful indication of how for every new country that wants to come in, there's a jealous neighbor that blocks it. So which is why I've come up with a new formula where we will have seven permanent members who represent the great powers of today and not the great powers of yesterday. So it will be, of course, USA, China, and Russia. And then the European Union can have a single seat because they have a common European foreign and security policy now. And the three new members, one from each continent, will be India from Asia, Nigeria from Africa, and Brazil from Latin America. But the most significant difference in my formulation is that I'm also suggesting the creation of seven semi-permanent seats. So all those losers, like South Korea, like Pakistan, like Italy, like Argentina, will then become semi-permanent members of the Security Council, whereby they get automatically a seat in the Security Council every four terms. So, and then, of course, there are seven more seats for the elected members. So the advantage of this 7-7-7 formula is that the seven great powers of today from all regions are represented, the seven represented from middle powers are represented, and seven represented from small states are represented. So it's a win-win-win formula. That's why I think the 7-7-7 formula can break the logjam in Security Council reform.
And did you also want to add an additional 28 seats for
That's
semi-permanent
right.
membership?
That's right. So the seven semi-permanent members will be selected from the 28 middle powers of the day. And I work out and I established their ranking in the world by looking at the combination of their average of their global share of GNP and the average of their global share of population. So I give equal weight to economic prowess as well as population size.
Which is really interesting because right now, if you don't have the economic prowess to match the population size, you really are left with very little power.
That's right. So, but now, you see, with this formulation, all the new rising powers will automatically be recognized. So in a sense, this formula will put a premium on tomorrow's great powers and not yesterday's great powers or middle powers to be represented in the Security Council.
Does adding all those additional voices make it harder to reach a consensus?
Well, actually, the reason why I picked the number 21, and it wasn't just randomly picked from the air, because it has been American policy, declared American policy, not to allow an increase of the Security Council beyond the size of 21, because many American diplomats, including former ambassadors to the UN like Tom Pickering, have told me that it's really tough enough to get agreement with 15. And so the maximum that United States will allow an increase to is 21. So I know that the United States has been frightened of Security Council reform, which is why I came up with the number 21, which falls within American policy and not outside American policy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Augustine in Fort Worth. Hello, Augustine.
Hi. I was just wondering, to your guest, how do you compare the foreign nations moving up so rapidly to the way they're graduating the students from the United States? So, like, students from Asia and Africa come over, they study, and then they go back after they study. And, of course, they transfer technology, they transfer best practices over to their country, and then they're going to improve them. While in the U.S., they are cutting back on education, educational grants, and maybe in child care and so forth. How do you compare the future in those terms?
Well, the good news, and I'm glad you highlighted the fact that many of the people who are responsible for the great convergence in the world are actually graduates of American universities, and they bring back home the best practices of American society, the best practices of American education, and implement them back home, and that's why their countries are succeeding. And here, I think the caller is absolutely right. That is a pity that America is cutting back its investment in infrastructure, in education, when it should be doing more, because clearly today, you know, when I fly from Beijing Airport to John F. Kennedy Airport, I fly from a first world airport in Beijing to a third world airport in New York City. And that's very sad because America has always been known to be the leader in many of these areas, but America is slipping behind, which is why it needs to focus on long-term investment in these areas.
Why stick with institutions that already exist, but do, I think even you would concede, have some problems and a history of problems in terms of balance. Why not start fresh and try to create something brand new?
Well, this is where my 33 years of experience in diplomacy comes in. And I know that in the real world, if you try to create a new architecture, especially a new diplomatic architecture, it's the hardest thing in the world. But if you take existing institutions and try to rejuvenate them, it's much easier. As one reviewer said, Kishore, you're trying to pour new wine into old bottles. And I said, absolutely right. Because if you take the UN General Assembly, what the world needs, since we're all sailing on the same boat, is a global parliament where we can all talk to each other. Now, if you try to create a global parliament from scratch, it's almost impossible. But if you take the UN General Assembly, which, and by the way, as far as I know, over the last 20, 30 years, the American president has without fail addressed the UN General Assembly. Why? Because it is the only place where the American president can go to talk at the same time to 193 countries. And that's why the UN General Assembly is so important. But the UN General Assembly has been allowed, sadly, to deteriorate. And I know that because I was ambassador to the UN for over 14 years. But I also know, as an ambassador, that it can be revived. It can be done. That's why I strongly advocate the rejuvenation of the UN General Assembly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Craig in Dallas. Hi, Craig.
Hi. My question is this. Your guest just mentioned that there's 193 countries that are in the United Nations. How does he see the blending of the founding religions of all of these 193 countries coming together, and what role does he think the founding religion will have globally?
Well, I have actually very good news on that count because, you know, ever since Samuel Huntington wrote his book, The Clash of Civilizations, there's grown a great suspicion in the West that when different religions come together, clashes are inevitable. And here, you know, one of the things I do in my book is to talk about the most diverse, the most balkanized region in the world, which of course is Southeast Asia. And I point out that in the most balkanized region in the world, where you have over 300 million Muslims, more Muslims than North Africa, where you have 80 million Christians, where you have over 150 million Buddhists, and then you have Taoists and Confucianists and even Communists, guess what? In that most diverse and most balkanized region of the world, Southeast Asia, which was destined to be a region of clashes and conflict, has now become the second most peaceful region in the world after the European Union. Why? Because of a multilateral organization called ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. So ASEAN provides in some ways a microcosm of the future. So if 600 million people can succeed to live together in peace with so many religions, it shows that 7 billion people can do the same.
What is the most important step in strengthening the UN? Is it about member states really pledging anew to sort of follow the dictates of the UN for global governance? Is it about money?
Well, it's actually, there are three simple steps that can be taken. The first simple step is to decide that it is in Western national interests to strengthen these organizations. And once you make that decision, then the second decision you make is that from now on, I'm going to pick the strongest possible person to become the heads of these organizations rather than the weakest possible person. And one of the dirty little secrets I've given in my book is that it has been American policy, and here I quote John Bolton and Condi Rice, who actually put it on record, say that they wanted to see weak secretary generals rather than strong secretary generals. And thirdly, of course, the crucial thing is money. And here, the amazing thing is that, you know, if we are all on the same boat, and I'm sorry to mention this, you know, the recent Carnival cruise boat?
Yes.
And you saw what happened to the passengers when everything breaks down. It didn't matter if you were living in the first class or below the deck. When the systems break down in the boat, you all suffer, right? We are in the same boat. So why are we weakening an institution like the World Health Organization? Because if you are worried about pandemics coming, you should be giving more money to the World Health Organization, more regular assessed budget contributions. But as I reveal in the book, the regular assessed budget contributions to the WHO have gone down from 75% to 25%. This is insanity. Because if you're on the same boat, don't weaken the WHO, because the pandemics will hit you no matter which cabin you're in.
Does a declining Western share of global GDP mean a declining share of financial responsibility for helping the rest of the world solve its problems?
Yes. In fact, the UN works on the formula that you contribute on the basis of your share of the global GNP. And frankly, countries like China and India need to contribute more and should contribute more to the organizations like the United Nations. And the amount of money involved is peanuts. You know, the total cost of the UN Secretariat in the UN per year is about $1.4, $1.5 billion a year. And then New York City spends that amount of money on one fire department in New York City. So if you can afford to pay for the New York City Fire Department, you can afford to save the world.
Let's talk about how all of this might relate to climate change and the things that need to happen on a global scale in order to prevent the worst of it.
Well, climate change actually provides the most powerful living evidence that we are on the same boat. As you know, a few days ago, Tom Friedman had a column quoting from a new study by Anne Marie Slaughter that points out how climate change is stressing out the world. And it doesn't matter where you are, whether you're living in a first-class cabin on the boat or below the deck, climate change is going to hit you. So to solve the problem, the challenges of climate change or global warming, we need to come up with a new equitable formula where we distribute sacrifice to everyone. And quite naturally, the richer countries, which have been, in a sense, emitting more greenhouse gas emissions for 200 years or so, need to pay more. But as you know, the problem in the world today is that no politician can mention the word sacrifice. So on the one hand, you have the most eloquent spokesmen against global warming, people like Al Gore and Tom Friedman in America. But at the same time, no American politician can say it is time to make a sacrifice, because if they do so, they'll be voted out of office.
Can the positive change taking place economically in the developing world continue and also be environmentally sustainable?
Well, that's exactly the big challenge the world faces, which is why I'm writing this book now, because I think if we want an environmentally sustainable world, you do not want to live in a world where 1.3 billion Chinese have two SUVs per household, like the Americans. Because believe me, if we move into a world where 1.3 billion Chinese have two SUVs per household like America, then the planet will fry. But if you want the Chinese to not buy SUVs to drive around, then America's got to lead by example and got to show, hey, we should actually move towards a world where maybe develop electric cars or less gas consumption or whatever it is. Keep raising the environmental standards in America as high as possible in the hope that China will match them. But the lower that America sets the environmental standards, the easier it will be for China to meet them. So this is why it is in America's national interest to push for the highest global environmental standards and start applying them to America first.
How open, I suppose tacitly, do you find the Obama administration to these ideas, if no one's speaking about any of this publicly?
Well, I mean, as you know, I'm a great fan and supporter of Obama, as I describe in the book. But, you know, when he was inaugurated in January 2009, he gave a brilliant speech in which he said, I will not be the first American president to allow the planet to fry or something like that. And yet, fast forward 4 years later, when he was running for re-election in 2012, he told his campaign advisors, please do not mention global warming or climate change, for we will lose votes. And that's sad, because if you cannot speak the hard truths to the American public, that's very sad. This is why I hope when President Obama in his second term will take advantage of the fact he's not running for re-election to now tell the American people the hard truths they need to hear.
My guest is Kishore Mahbubani. He's a writer, professor, and former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations. He has a new book out called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at 6:30 at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kishore Mahbubani, a writer, professor, and former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations. His new book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I'd just like to make this person's ambassador to Singapore. Singapore, just the whole country, is a small city. It's not like it's a giant country. I've been to over 50 countries, been to Southeast Asia. There's nothing fantastic there. They have different religions in some of the countries. Into India, China, all these. Countries seem to do better in countries where it's just one religion, not, you know, a number of religions. That's what he's saying is not true.
Well, you know, I think your caller is absolutely right. That's the perception, that when you have many different religions, you expect to see a lot of conflict and divisions, and which is why the Southeast Asian story is so fascinating, because when you have Muslims, Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Taoists, Confucianists and communists living together in peace, 600 million people, it provides a very powerful social and human laboratory that demonstrates how different religions can live together. And actually, I begin the book by quoting from a book by a Harvard professor, Steven Pinker, called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And if you read Steven Pinker's book, he provides overwhelming evidence that violence and conflict is diminishing in human society.
Have we moved beyond the time where, for example, in Europe in the last century, there was a lot of territorial battle and a lot of conquest? Are we about to see the end of that sort of fighting?
Well, I think overall, the statistics show very clearly that wars, especially interstate wars, are becoming a sunset industry. And just as you have, middle-class families in America do not want to send their children into battle. That's why you got out of Vietnam. So in the same way, middle-class families all over the world, including in China and India and in Southeast Asia or in Africa, do not want to send their children into battle. And that's why, and since global middle classes are exploding, the populations who want to go to war are diminishing. And that's why the world is getting a better and better place. In fact, if you read my book, you'll just drown in optimism.
Let's talk about the World Bank and the IMF, which historically have had an American or European at the helm.
Yeah.
What is the greatest concern about that reality to all the other countries in the world that haven't had a shot at being in charge of either of those institutions?
Well, I mean, as you know, there are many antiquated policies in our world which carry on long after their sell-by date. And one of this, of course, is a rule that was established in the 1940s that the head of the World Bank should always be an American and the head of the IMF should always be a European. And even though at the G20 leaders meeting in London in April 2009, they actually agreed, all the G20 leaders agreed, that the next IMF and World Bank leaders should be chosen on merit and not by geographical origin. And yet, when one Frenchman got into trouble, and we all know why he got into trouble, he was immediately replaced by a French woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an example of an old policy that has got to change, because you cannot have a situation where the only people who are qualified to run the world's most powerful economic organizations come from only 12% of the world's population and basically disenfranchise 88% of the world's population. And it's a bit like global apartheid.
How effective was the G20 at mitigating some of the worst effects of the economic crisis that hit starting in 2008?
Well, I think, frankly, the world should send the G20 a big thank you note for what they accomplished in London under the prime ministership of Gordon Brown in the April 2009 meeting. Because frankly, if that G20 leaders meeting, basically where all the leaders of the world came out of their cabins on the boat and went up to the bridge to launch a coordinated global stimulus to stimulate the global economy, if they hadn't done that, we would have been in deep trouble. So the G20 really did a magnificent job in the 2008-2009 financial crisis. But sadly, as soon as the crisis was over, they went back into their cabins and began to bicker again. And that's why, as you know, the global economy is not doing so well since the crisis.
It sounds similar to what happens even with a health crisis. We have seen really remarkable examples of international coalitions coming together to deal with pandemics. But then again, when things fall away, it seems like a lot of that collaboration falls off.
Yes, and I think this shows that something is wrong in our human nature, that we only seem to respond when a crisis hits us, and yet when something that is long-term, that is coming our way, is inevitable, we don't seem to have the capacity to respond like global warming. And so we are behaving a bit like the frog. You know, they say that when you throw the frog into boiling water, he jumps out immediately. But when you put the frog in a pot and boil it slowly, slowly, the frog is quite happy and doesn't jump out. And that's basically, so we are actually reacting to global warming like the frog in a pot that is warming up slowly.
So, Kishore, what is the alternative to making these shifts, allowing emerging nations to take on a greater share of global governance? What happens if we don't do that?
Well, I think if we don't do it, then clearly we're creating a prescription for trouble because, as you know, we used to live in the feudal order in the past where a few feudal lords would make decisions and the man in the street, a woman in the street, had no say in their future. And essentially, the current world order, which is dominated by the West, represents that old feudal order where a few powerful Western countries are running IMF, World Bank, and controlling what happens at the UN and so on and so forth. And that cannot survive in a world where the global middle classes are exploding. But I want to emphasize that what I'm actually advocating is not against the interests of the West, but it's actually in the interests of the West to do these things. And this is why I use the phrase from Steven Pinker's book called The Escalator of Reason. The rest of humanity, guess what? The 88% who live outside the West are marching up the escalator of reason and becoming very rational, pragmatic participants of the global order. So they're not out to dominate the West. They're trying to replicate the West, and they want to work with the West. And the tragedy is that the Western mind, and this is one of the most provocative things I say in my book, is the line I use is that the difference between America and China is that America is an open society but with a closed mind, whereas China may be a closed society with an open mind. And this is a paradox that few Americans have absorbed, that they've got to look at the world completely differently from the way they have looked at it for the past 50 years.
So do you think the struggle of the United States and the European West to make these changes are the things that we fear are precisely that the rest of the world will behave as we have behaved over the past century?
Well, it's very hard to understand what these Western fears are. And the tragedy is that, of course, since the 2008-2009 financial crisis, Western populations in Europe and in America have become very wary of things like, say, global trade liberalization. And frankly, global trade liberalization is good for the world, good for America, good for Europe, and good for the rest of the world too. So America should march on and strengthen these policies, the policies that America used to advocate for global trade liberalization, and not back away from them when the world is embracing them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Sharmina in Richardson. Hi, Sharmina.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I didn't catch the beginning of the show, so I'm not sure if the speaker went into more detail, but I just heard a comment about how the world is actually becoming less violent and less involved in wars. And I kind of feel like when I turn on the news, it seems otherwise, and especially lately with, you know, sectarian, you know, violence in Pakistan, Bangladesh, in the Middle East. So is the speaker trying to say that it's less in areas where the religion is more diverse, or I'm not understanding quite well?
That's an excellent question, and I'm glad the questioner asked the question. If you open your newspaper, you only get bad news. So you'll hear about killings in Syria, killings in Mali, killings in Pakistan. And that's perfectly normal. Newspapers only report bad news, and they never report good news. But social scientists, as you know, look at statistics. And Steven Pinker does that. Many UN academics have done it. And the statistics show very clearly that if you look at the 7 billion people in the world, the 7 billion people in the world today are leading far more peaceful lives than their predecessors ever did. And look at China as an example, right? From 1842, as you know, when the Opium War, which many people have forgotten, the British bombarded Chinese ports and forced them to accept British opium in return for Chinese tea. And then after that, they had civil wars. And then after that, even after 1949, they had the Great Leap Forward. Then they had the Cultural Revolution. So the Chinese experienced almost 130 years of constant conflict. And guess what? The last 30 years have been the best years that China has had in 200 years. And that's true of many other parts of the world, too. If you look at India, for example, you know, recently the British Prime Minister finally went to India to apologize for the Amritsar massacre. You know, the Indians were downtrodden under British rule for a couple of hundred years. Guess what? Now they're free and independent and growing a major middle class. So violence is actually diminishing in human existence. And I'm glad that callers are challenging me with these questions, because the data in my book proves very convincingly that the world is getting better and better.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sally in Addison. Hi, Sally.
Hello. This is Sally, actually, F-A-L-L-Y.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to commend your guest for speaking the truth. I wish our politicians in the United States would have the same guts to tell us the facts on the ground. But my question is, actually, he mentioned a lot of development and projections about China, Africa, and some other countries, Brazil, and India. But how do the lack of civil liberties and the lack of, freedom of speech and freedom of innovation affect or curtail the development that have been projected in these countries in the long run? Because I think that's what put the United States ahead of these countries. We may have a lot of numbers out there, but, you know, if people don't have freedom to innovate or to have basic necessities to think, I think, you know, in the future, it would still affect the development of those countries.
Fally, thank you so much for your call.
I agree. I actually agree that the United States is ahead, and I hope the United States will remain ahead for many years to come. But let me just compare United States with China. You know, when I first went to China in 1980, 32 years ago, in Beijing, you know, there were no skyscrapers, there were no neon signs, there were no cars, there were only bicycles. And the Chinese people could not even choose what to wear. They couldn't wear a jacket and tie. They could only wear Maoist outfits. They could not leave their villages. They could not decide where to work, what job to take. And they certainly could not afford to leave the country, China, right? That was 30 years ago. Today, the Chinese people travel around China, decide what jobs to have many more opportunities. They have wonderful Western-style universities in China. And each year, 70 million Chinese leave China freely. And guess what? 70 million Chinese return to China freely. Are they mad? Are they going back to some kind of despotic, dangerous dictatorial rule? Or are they going back to a China where the Chinese people have seen an explosion of personal freedoms on a scale that they haven't experienced in centuries? So this explosion of personal freedoms explains the remarkable performance of China over the last 30 years. And certainly in innovation, China is behind America. That's a fact. But the question is China catching up? And I think it is.
Kishore Mahbubani is the former ambassador of Singapore to the United Nations and current dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. His new book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. He will speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel. Kishore, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.